This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded land of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to the people of the Kulin Nation and all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander elders, past and present.
This is the First Time Podcast.
It's us talking writing and publishing.
Welcome to our Masters series,
where we interview Australian and international authors at the top of their games.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast.
Masters Series.
Hello, Catherine Collette from the wardrobe.
From the wardrobe, the echoey wardrobe. Hopefully Phoebe's able to take out that.
I know. I apologize, everyone.
You are on retreat again. Okay. I wanted to. I was thinking earlier this morning, it would be interesting to know the number of days you've managed to squeeze into retreats this year.
It would be. And it would be interesting as well to see the amount of work that I squeezed into those days, because it is so much phenomenally higher than when I could be at home.
That would make a great graph of work per day retreat versus work per day normal life.
So for instance,
it'd be like an 80-20 rule.
Exactly. This one's only 4 days. So this is with the novel lab group that I'm part of through RMIT and the PhD. And we had a little grant for this. And I couldn't do the whole week, but for the first 2 days, I managed to fully read through the manuscript and mark it up. There is just no way I could do that at home. I think even if I had from 9 to 5 at home, like even if the kids were at childcare, I still don't think I could do that. So, I am
grants, wardrobe. Grants for retreats, though. That feels like a secret we shouldn't be letting out.
I know.
A brilliant idea.
I know. Go for all the grants, people. I was just thinking about this. I don't know what your plan is for next year, but you know how they say, you know, you do all the grants for the same thing. And of course, like the idea of, oh my gosh, some point I'll have to start thinking about a new project. And I would love to know if there is a secret spreadsheet someone has somewhere that says, if you write this kind of project, you are more likely to get all the grants, because that would be a spreadsheet I'd like to see. Anyway, grants.
Grants. The other grant idea that I was always very taken by, which I don't even know if it's true, but I had heard that Jock's Wrong, for some reason it's attributed to him, had put in a grant for a writing studio, which I think is a great idea for a grant.
Yes, totally. It's kind of like a permanent retreat, right? Surely you get more bang for your buck on that. Catherine, this is our final episode recording, our catch up for the year.
Has been an enormous year.
It has been an enormous year. And because I, like you, I imagine time has become somewhat meaningless over the last 3 or 4 years, and we no longer know what happens in what year. I did go back and listen to last year's finale episode just to kind of get my head in the game of what we talk about in finales. And we were just coming out of lockdown.
Oh, amazing.
Coming out of a lockdown. We didn't have Jill. We hadn't started the Masters series, and you had not yet released the competition. That's what we were talking about, like the fact that your book was coming out in February. So I kind of don't even know where to begin, except that seems the right place to talk about the fact that this year started with the competition coming out.
Yeah, it feels like a very long time ago. God, I can't ever go back and listen willingly to any of the episodes, but the finale would be one of the best off the top of my head. In fact, I think the finale of the first season is one of our most popular episodes.
It's so
funny.
But
I digress. So bizarre. Competition came out in Feb. I have to say that was one of the highlights of the year. Probably, I imagine, in that finale episode, I would have been saying how excited I was while being quietly terrified.
Yes. When does the terror stop?
Oh, I don't think it ever stops. Mm. I had a dinner earlier this week with a group of writers that was such a just incredible group and lovely dinner. But one of the things that we talked about briefly was the shame. And I think the shame is so unexpected, but so seemingly so universal. I'm so fascinated by the
unpack the shame a bit, the shame of just putting yourself out there, that unskinned feeling, or
I think the, sh- the uns the unskimmed. The feeling of, for me, I think the feeling of putting something out into the world that is so inadequate and maybe also being proud of it at the same time.
Mm.
Maybe those two things can feel like they hold true.
Yeah, I think they do. I think they do, because as soon as you have to stop, right, as soon as that's what you would have been in when we were talking last December, in that moment where you can't make any more changes now, it is out of your control. There's nothing more you can do. And that's a terrifying thing, because we know we never actually feel like that, like it's done.
It's funny though, because you feel the terror or the apprehension or just that feeling of being daunted. You do feel excited at the same time. But the terror never comes to fruition.
Mm.
In the sense that it's an anticipation terror.
Yeah.
Because when I was thinking back of what I most enjoyed, and it was the launch, and it was going to Brisbane and going to Sydney and having events and having people come to those events, because it's such a show of generosity and support to go and see someone's event. I mean, obviously you may also just be interested, but often, you know, it's both. It was a lot of highs. Like the nervousness or the harder parts were mostly self-inflicted in my head. They weren't really grounded in any truth.
So is there one particular moment? So you've talked about highlights there. Is there one particular moment that you would say was the low light, considering we make people discuss this with us all the time?
Oh, the low light. It's a tough moment to be publishing books. I think you hope that every book that you release is going to be a bestseller and be wildly, wildly runaway popular. It's going to sell in multiple territories. It's going to be on the lists that are coming out now of people's favorite books. And the competition, whilst I'm very proud of it and it did well in lots of ways, it was different to the Helpline in that it didn't go into a lot of territories, or it hasn't yet, maybe is a better way to put it.
Yes, let's talk potential.
Yeah, that's right. So I don't know if disappointment is the right word, but I think there's a reality around that that I'm sure other writers that are listening to this podcast, and I've certainly had other conversations, sometimes there's that gap between your hopes and what you wish for a book and where it lands. And I don't think that's an uncommon experience.
That is so common, so utterly common. What do you think you did much better this time, your second time around?
I think I knew what to expect. So small things like having events and traveling or doing book promotion stuff. I didn't try to write in that time, which is such a simple thing, whereas perhaps the first time around I thought that was possible.
Yeah.
I really liked that Ben Crowe kind of philosophy. I think it's Dylan Alcott who talks about fuck it, how good is this?
Yes.
And so I did come back to that idea a lot because so much of that stuff is in your head about sort of nervousness. I don't even know if nervousness is the right word, but that unskinned feeling.
Yeah.
But how good is this, right? Like when I think I was probably 30 when I started writing The Helpline, I would have just looked at this moment of having a second book come out, getting to go places, having people turn up. The podcast is always a really big part of events, probably for you too, in the sense that you get a lot of listeners that will come to things. Just that constant reminder of fuck it, how good is this? And then the other bit to that is just be me.
I love that. I'm going to take, you know how people do that kind of like phrase for their next year? I now have two because you've reminded me of that one again. So for next year, I'm going to take in that fuck it, how good is this? Absolutely. I'm going to write it up and put it in a post-it note above my desk. And I'm also taking in the dear one that I know lots of particularly women are using right now, but it is widely used in my darling high school girls chat. Not for me. Just not for me.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
I have not heard of that at all.
Thanks so much for the opportunity. Not for me. Thanks for asking.
That.
Not for me.
It's also just like a comparison sort of thing, you know?
Cool. You love that. Not for me.
Not for me.
So that's what I am. Ooh, that's what I am going to take in.
Yeah. I love that.
Mm.
I'm going to put that in my arsenal of things.
Practical question, because I was talking about this with some writers who have books coming out next year recently. When you said about realizing that you just weren't going to get the writing done in that time. What in terms of like taking time off work or practically putting boundaries around that release time, what did you put in place this second time around, knowing what would be expected of you in terms of publicity and what you expected of yourself?
Good question. I think I probably am lucky in the sense that at that time I was working 3 days a week. I'm working 4 days a week now, so I'm very much feeling the pinch of time. So I could be pretty flexible in the movement of days and those kinds of things. But I guess I just focused on doing my best to enjoy that process and to put in perspective and to feel grateful. And I think I did succeed at that. And the other thing I did a lot of, which is probably part of everyday life, but I made sure to do was just exercise. I think it's such a good aspect of mental health. I don't know that I did a lot differently aside from that. Coming out of that space of lockdowns, it just felt doubly different. You know, getting to go to Brisbane, getting to go to Sydney and stay in a hotel. Yeah, I think that in itself lent itself to feeling excited.
One more question. In terms of things that you continue to do in terms of publicity and promotion through the year, like, for instance, the stuff you did with Toastmasters, how much of that did you keep momentum going for and organise yourself, and how much was kind of driven by publisher?
I was super lucky with all of that stuff. So Jane Watkins, who was at Text at the time, I think she's not at Text anymore, but she had organized a bunch of stuff, but a lot of that stuff was very much concentrated around the publication date. I had a couple of I had Queenscliff Writers Festival and Williamstown Writers Festival, which came a bit later, but the Toastmasters stuff was all Toastmasters initiated. So I was very lucky in that sense in tapping into an enthusiastic and pretty large existing community that has stuff like magazines and podcasts and conferences and all those sorts of things.
Have you gone back to Toastmasters and done a speech that talks in any way or references your book?
I haven't, but the Sydney-based Toastmasters, I'm not sure what area or district they are, have invited me to come to their conference, which will be in May next year. So I'm excited about that. I'll do a speech there. I've also asked Ashley Calasian Blunt to come along. So I thought we could do a bit of a Q&A. She obviously has a background in Toastmasters. She also has a background in stand-up comedy, but she has a book, Dark Mode, that'll be coming out around about the same time. So I haven't even thought about the content of that, but it will feature Toastmasters and books and bits and pieces. I always have this cautiousness around the Toastmasters thing, because a lot of my book is satire. I think it's a love letter in many ways to Toastmasters and public.
It is.
But it's also... you know, it also pokes fun, right? And I remember them talking about this in the podcast about whether that was a concern for me in interacting with Toastmasters so much. So yeah, it's a funny space. I feel like I can tell when someone has read the book and when they haven't.
You just mentioned stand-up comedy. So another question on what you've been doing this year. Have you carried on your improv?
I have not. So I really love the improv. I would highly, highly recommend it to everyone. There are 6 levels that you go through and then you're an improv master. I think I probably peaked at level 2, but moved to level 3 and did level 3. I got a lot out of it, but wouldn't say it's a young man's sport or a young person's sport, but it's a time commitment because I think it's a 3-hour class and then you have to go to a show every week. If you want to get good, you have to practice and those sorts of things. I wish I had done it in my 20s, only in the sense that you could go all in.
Yeah.
You know, there's no sort of impact on family and commitments if you're out three nights of the week. So, but yeah, I would highly recommend it to anyone. It's very non-threatening too, which I think people would be surprised by.
A question without notice, what did doing that improv lend to your writing?
I think it brought the fun back for sure. And silliness. And I think it just gave me confidence in the sense of like comics would have very much, the cartoons and things that I've been doing would very much born of an improv impulse in that it's creative and fun and you can throw it away. It doesn't have to be so labored and so self-conscious. That idea of improv as because really an improv show, you'll have a show, you might have a wonderful show of this group performing on stage, and it's an interaction between the people that are on stage and the people in the audience, and it can never happen again.
Yes.
And there's something in that, that fleetingness, and in that, you know, that's really liberating. That's what I took.
On cartoons, because I was impacted, like potentially some of our listeners have been, and I think you were, by the ridiculous Instagram algorithm cock up, I stopped seeing anyone for about a week and a half. So have you kept up your cartoon a day?
I have dropped off on daily. I was desperate to do daily. I'm still going to hit my 100 because I'm working 4 days at the moment, and it's Christmas has ramped up and all of those kinds of things. I'm giving myself some grace with that, but we go away on the 16th up to Bradley, and I will start again then. Which I'm excited about. It's a really fun practice. I enjoy it, and I'm now following a lot of cartoonists on Instagram, and it is so much more fun in the sense that it just is such a positive to look at people's cartoons.
Yeah, what your feed looks
like. It's just like my feed is great. So yeah. It's good.
Well, I'm very much enjoying them, yours, and I know other people are. It's really nice looking at the comments on them too.
I am now going to flip this around. Let's go back to the start of the year. Cast your mind back. I'm imagining this like thing happening, a blurring of the video image. Where were you? What were you doing at the start of the year writing-wise?
So at the start of this year, I had my exploded novel because that's what I'd done this time last year. I went away for the December retreat, which I must just say, like, the first time that I got given a bit of time in December, I was like, there's absolutely no way I can take that. Like, December's just a write-off. And then I was like, no, your work is writing your novels. And so you have to actually get that work done. And you can't just write off a whole month of the year because of Christmas anxiety and end of year anxiety and all the things you have to do. So last December is when I exploded the original kind of novel that I had. And so
was this our writers group retreat? That was in December. That one, so was this a different one?
That one was when I went to the beautiful Butterfly House in Dramana. So I exploded it. So, you know, January, February, the start of this year, I was still kind of trying to put it back together or thinking about how to put it back together. So what this year has looked like has been me writing this new version of the novel, and lots of things have helped that. Like I did 2 Sarah Centilli's Word Caves. I've had retreats. I've had the kind of support now of this novel lab group through RMIT and through the PhD. And of course, like, the PhD has impacted that as well. I was looking back on my Instagram to see what I'd actually read this year. I was like, how spells? Like, I have not got a lot of books in here. And partly it's because so much reading has also been taken up by the PhD. So at the start of this year, I had a big mess that I knew I wanted to finish. I think I probably said I wanted to finish by the end of this year in some capacity. And I think I've done that. In some capacity.
So, I mean, that makes it sound like a very simple process. Along the way, what has been easier and what has been unexpectedly more difficult?
I think that the generative writing, the putting down of words, I always quite enjoy, and that's quite fun for me. And I don't go back and revise during, like, while I'm writing. Like, I just have a huge mess. The big breakthrough, so that's what I was doing for the first half of the year. And then the big breakthrough, I think, came for me in July, when I worked out a kind of an overarching structure and a shape for the book. And that has really informed the way that it came together in this second part of the year. And can I say, there would be, I mean, people, I hope I've communicated this enough, but there would have been absolutely no way that I would have got my draft into the publisher had I not had that 3-week residency in New Zealand, because I really did get an incredible amount of writing done there, and deleting and thinking and structuring that I just find absolutely impossible to do amid daily life. That's just the way it works for me. That's just my practice, and I've worked it out now. So that's a good thing. Yeah, I needed to have that complete immersion because it's a relatively complicated structure. and kind of a multi-strand novel, I needed that time and space to kind of put it all back together. So I did get it to the publisher and I did hear back. I know that I mentioned last time that I was in that exquisitely painful waiting period. And the darling Ashley Collegian Blunt, who you just mentioned, I was actually with, thank you, Ashley, in Sydney when I did take the call from my publisher to give me some feedback and to talk about next steps. So we're moving on. I'm in edits. That's what I'm doing this week. And it's been so delightful to head shift mm-hmm. in that way of going away from composition phase and getting down to that on the line. Is that voice right? Have I said everything I want to about this character? Is this world right? Like that stuff, it feels much more mathematical or something else. It's just a completely different frame of mind. So that feels really good to be in that space now.
It feels like progress too, doesn't it?
Yes.
Like being in that generative stage for so long.
Yeah.
I think is taxing.
And I think too, the thing of having after working on screen for so long, the thing of having a physical copy where you can like mark it up and tag it and the rest of it, and then just like slap the pages down. Yes, I've done that bit. Like I've inputted all the changes that can sit now. There's something that I find very pleasing about that material aspect of kind of working through actual pages as well. So watch this space for what it looks like next year.
So does this mean post-retreat or say post-Christmas, you do nothing for a little bit or are you?
Unfortunately, it's not quite at that stage. And my January, okay. Like your January, is kind of out for work. It is full kid vibe. Hats off, by the way, to our friends in Queensland whose children have already been off for like a week and a bit already.
Why?
I know. Because there's
school holidays.
Yeah. Yeah. Kay Kerr message.
State yep. school.
Yeah. So we see you, Queensland, and we feel for you. Not that your kids aren't lovely, obviously. It's just that it's a very long time.
I did see a great post on Instagram that was like, my two favorite things are being with my children and not being with my children.
Yes. That's exactly it.
Really resonates.
Yeah. So look, I'm hoping that that I can push through and get some more done before Christmas in this mad thing. Though I did look at my calendar properly yesterday and go, oh, it's quite close. And then, yeah, January won't necessarily get much work done, but then I'll be
do
up
you,
to
do you
the next
go to
stage.
The extent that, do you go to the extent that you don't even take a computer away?
Yeah, mostly. Yeah. I mean, I wonder if this year the idea of working through edits will be a bit different, whether maybe I could come at that. But my partner has shifted jobs, so he doesn't have any leave. And while we're with a very big and very generous and amazing supportive group of campers, I will mostly be solo parenting. So potentially that won't work. So yeah, we'll see how we go. But a big worky first part of the year is my plan. Going hard, forward, finish, as they say in Sarah Centerly's word. Okay, let's go into some reflections. We have had some discussion of this because obviously this time of year is when people do their finales and people do their best of lists and they do a big wrap up on, they say these were, you know, definitively the highlights, the best books, etc. of the year. And you and I both find that deeply problematic.
We did do it with Booktopia and I think we tried to mention as many, you know, books and things that we loved because there is a lot to love, but I think we both came off feeling a bit dirty.
Yeah.
In the sense that
you can never fit all the books.
Great if you're on it. You can, yeah. You know, people's best of are invariably of the books they have read. Right?
Exactly.
So.
And that's what's terrifying to me in a way, looking at the best of lists at this time of year, where you go, oh my gosh, I just didn't get around to reading any of those. So it is a good time. I must admit what I did earlier this week, the Lit Hub Best Books of 2022 came out. And I remember that as a moment that I always open up my library app and I just put a bunch of them on hold for the new year because they're never Australian books in Lit Hub's Best Books. And so they're overseas ones potentially I hadn't heard of yet. And so I just put them all on hold, except that I have overdue books, so I couldn't do it. But I've got a list of them to put on. So
how
in that light
is library apps with
oh my
reservations?
Gosh. library apps. And also no fines anymore.
I was about to say, a $20-something fine. I didn't have to pay.
No, we don't have to pay. We just have to find the books and return them. So we get that lot.
a separate challenge.
A separate issue. Yeah. So we're going to talk about reads and listens and moments from the podcast that have stood out to us or that we're just thinking about right now. So I'm going to throw to you first. What are your highlights from the interviews and the podcast this year, Catherine Collette?
This is probably the only one I'm doing as a little bit of a highlight. I think two interviews I particularly enjoyed this year, and they were the Kim Scott interview and the Chloe Huber interview. I think I enjoyed them so much because I was completely daunted about speaking to both of these writers, and I prepared a lot. I was like, these guys are really good. I know nothing. They know everything. But to me, they were really interesting conversations. I was really happy with how those interviews turned out. So they were my two faves.
Just remind us of the delightful kind of industry gossip that Chloe Huber revealed in your podcast.
Well, she did talk about, what's his name? Philip Roth.
That's right.
First introduction. She had him as a teacher. And I think he was maybe overly friendly was potentially how we'll put it.
Let's leave it there.
They were interesting conversations. I think it's always really nice talking to writers about early writing life. And I think people really like that. And I remember Kim talking about how he liked Phantom Comics, which is not something I would necessarily have expected. So they were two podcast moments that stand out. The other is we're doing something different this year that we'll talk about in a little while that's called Follow a First Timer. But it made me go back. We were prepping for an interview that we'll do a snippet of in a little while in this episode. And I looked at some of the early questions that I had put together for different interviews. And it was that thing of realizing how far I had come. We often reflect on writing-based stuff and podcast-based stuff, but I haven't really reflected a lot on my own interviewing. And it made me realize how far I'd come. And I think this year for me really felt like a consolidation of skills. I think sometimes it's a linear progression, and sometimes progression feels like steps. And this year felt like a big step. So.
I love that. That's really good. And I love also the idea, because I think that potentially when you're in a workplace, a structured workplace, you have those tools in place at the end of year and at, reflection points or whatever, where you go back and you look at that kind of stuff. But as writers and podcasters or whatever else we do in the creative industries, we don't often have that opportunity to do it. So it's really nice to think, oh, I'm reflecting and I'm seeing that I got better at that thing. I think that's
cool. Well, and really to see it quite starkly, I guess. So that was nice.
I love those.
So tell me about your pods.
Well, when I was listening to that finale episode from last year, one of the things that struck me is that we were both talking about the enormous impact during the year of A Swim in the Pond in the Rain by George Saunders. And it just utterly blows my mind that we were doing that last year in December, and that this year I got to speak to him. And like, it was such a beautiful conversation. And I was that same thing, like so daunted, so nervous, had the bloody technical stuff up before it that made me even more nervous.
I know, I got panicked messages from you on the day. I have to confess, I haven't listened to it yet. So tell me all the things.
Well, just that he was so generous. I did really think that maybe the publicists hadn't confirmed, that maybe I would get 15 minutes. Like, it was his last Australian interview, end of the tour. And when we got on, he was like, what do you want? 6 hours? Like, he said, 1 hour is, does that seem all right? I was like, yes, George Saunders, it does. But I
just even saw the photos of him and you, and so proud.
So excited. But it was nice to be able to, even though that prep time had been so short, Saunders is one of those people who's a little bit like Charlotte Wood, who's kind of talking and writing about writing I know fairly well, because it's so helpful to me. It's one of those ones that I really like the anecdotes and the allegories and the examples that they give. And so it was lovely to be able to kind of ask him to go deeper on some of those things that have really been influential to me. So the thing about dropping the ball and it shattering. So that the idea that, you know, your story fully exists. And then as you go to tell it, you drop it and it shatters into a million pieces. And your job as the writer is to put it back together in a way that works. And he used that in an interview with Michael Williams, like back in 2017, but that has really stuck with me. So to be able to talk to him about like that, that's just such a thrill. And also the fact that so much of his writing craft advice is about revision, and that just fitted perfectly into the time that I'm in now. Like that felt really personally like something really special. But I also think there's another, you know, you're talking about seeing the shift. And I think one of the things that I learned from that experience too is like I hustled hard for that interview and I didn't think that I would get it by any means. But that over this past year with the masters and having success with people who have just said, you know, yes, okay, Sarah Widman, you know, yes, I'll speak to you. That you've just got to ask. You just got to ask, you know, and that yes, a lot of things have changed and yes, we now have more experience and yes, every person that we speak to allows us to be able to use them as a name that might potentially get us onto someone new, but also just really kind of being confident and warm and like, okay, if this doesn't work, but I am just going to ask because I think that has proved super beneficial to us this year and is part of what I want to do for the masters going forward.
I think, you know, there's so much bad that's come from COVID or so many difficult things, but there are some good things. And one is that technological shift and the kind of increased usage of things like Zoom, because an ask of George Saunders for 1 hour is so very different. You know, that's something he can do from his hotel room is so very different from, can you get on a plane or a train or a car and get here? Yeah. I think that's really helped us. I also wanted to say about him specifically, his voice on the page is so lovely that I feel like I know him already.
Yes.
Is his voice in real life the same? Like is his temperament and way of...
Yes. So, so warm and generous. And someone commented to me, there's been lots of lovely feedback. So thank you to everyone who has let us know you enjoyed the episode. But someone mentioned to me, you sound like you were smiling the whole time, Kate. And I was like, I was, because he is really just so warm and generous, exactly as he sounds on the page in person as well. So that was super lovely. But I think to the same degree, the things that I wanted to mention about highlights from the podcast this year were those moments of getting to ask these very specific people about ideas that I'd heard them talk about or I'd seen them writing about. So for instance, one of them was Michelle DeKretzer about keeping things small, about when you're feeling overwhelmed by the writing task ahead of you, whatever that might be, to kind of close the door around you and just start with a sentence or a paragraph. Like getting her to go into that was really, I really enjoyed that. The same as with Christos Tsolkas about that comment that I use all the time about being how he was destabilized by the success of the slap and kind of going into that. But I do think it has to be really my highlight, other than Saunders, has to be the moment where Sarah Winman turned into one of her characters by shifting her voice. And I was... you know, that was a really early episode this year and I was so blown away by it and just by the delight. I think that's when we started also showing video as well, showing little snippets of the video, because I think that there's something that not only the algorithm's enjoying about that, but that our listeners are enjoying about that and people about on Instagram are enjoying it too. There is something that I wanted to say because I really kind of want to write about this, but I'm not sure how to write about it yet, that has kind of come back to me. I'm not sure if it's come back to you anecdotally as well, that one of the things about the master series has been speaking to writers who are at a different level to maybe than what we've spoken to before, who are more experienced, who have more books under their belt and who also are potentially a little bit older and have come through publishing at different times. And at different times, there's been a little bit of anecdotal feedback about how some of the some of their experiences or advice doesn't necessarily fit as much anymore. And I think it's been really interesting for me to start to reflect just on how big the shifts in publishing and arts funding have been over the last kind of 20, 30 years in Australia, to see it come out in that way where people's experiences are so markedly different in terms of funding or the chance they might get if their second or third book is a flop, but they might have a publisher kind of stick by them. And I think that at a different point, and maybe not even for us to do, maybe when we get the transcripts up, someone else can look at this, but to kind of be able to analyze that that difference, that shift in the industry through these conversations would be something that's really interesting to do.
Mm.
Before we leave the podcast, we did a few different things this year and I wanted to mention them just so that we remember them. The Wheeler Center event with Yumna Kassab and Robert Lutkins was really fun, and other live events. So the one with Inga Simpson at readings and the one at Bendigo with Vanessa Len, which we know, listeners, we still do not have the audio for you, but we know that we will have it very soon. And as soon as we have it in our hot little hands, we will share it with you.
Okay. As we said, we are not doing best of reading lists this year. We are just doing current reads. I actually have an armful of listens. So I'm just going to mention one in the readings category. It's, and I hope I haven't mentioned it before, but it's Lessons in Chemistry by Bonnie Garmus. Have you read this?
Yes. Oh, I loved it.
What a delightful, delightful little book. It's fun. It's quick and easy, but I use those adjectives in very, very positive and as a great commendation. It's about it's set 1950s-ish era. It's about a woman who is a brilliant chemist. But of course, the world of chemists is fairly dominated by men. She gets fired and ends up on a cooking show. So she uses her chemistry skills in a cooking setting, and it becomes a beloved TV show, and various other things happen. It's such a lovely book, an easy read, perfect summer, holiday, beach, anywhere really that you are.
Yeah, I really loved that this year. And I just saw on Instagram this week that Nicole Abadie has spoken to her on her podcast. So I've got that lined up to listen to at some point as well. My ones that I've been reading this week, over the last little while, which I really enjoyed, Babel by R.F. Kuang.
I can visualize the cover of that.
It is so phenomenally good. Like, it's speculative history. So it's set in Oxford, in the realm of the translators. And it is weird and clever. And as it got towards the end, I absolutely could not put it down. Like just real plotty action, but also really big concepts about language and translation itself, but about colonization, about white women, about revolution, about workers' rights. Just, oh my goodness, I was utterly blown away. Kuang has gone to pretty much the top of my wish list for interviews for next year, though I'd say that she is a fairly busy woman because it's just
successful. Surely.
Maybe. We'll put it out there. So that I read. Also, ones that have been on my list for a while, short stories, Ling Ma, who wrote Severance, which I really loved a couple of years back, spec fic, very clever spec fic. Her new stories are called Bliss Montage. You might have seen the cover. It's a very cool cover with oranges under plastic, just a very striking cover. They are terrific. Ling Ma is also on my wish list. And I reckon too, I was just thinking about it, like short story collections this year that I have really enjoyed, and Casey Hardy's Cautionary Tales for Girls, Maggie Shipstead.
That has so much buzz, Cautionary Tales for Girls. It's sitting on my bedside table.
It's really good. And Maggie Shipstead was earlier this year with You Have a Friend in 10A. Chris Flynn's Here Be Leviathans, which is weird and wacky and wonderful. So I have really enjoyed short stories this year. I wanted to mention that. And summer reads, two that are on my summer read, are Amy Tunig's Tell Me I'm Here, which I haven't got to yet, but I'm very excited about, and Claire Fletcher's Five Bush Weddings. Are both, they're the two first packed in the box that I take camping. So tell me your listens.
Judicious with camping books. Well, yes.
No, but also I like to take personally the responsibility of taking along a library that everyone can benefit from. So I really quite enjoy that. You can just imagine when someone is having about to have their hammock time and says, Kate, have you got a book you can recommend? Do I have a book for you? I say.
You're a bibliotherapist and it justifies all of those purchases.
It really does.
For other people.
Okay, what have you been listening to?
I have been listening to all of the things. Where am I going to start? Okay, I will start with a podcast called This Is Dating. Its first season is out. It has some sort of loose affiliation with Esther Perel. I think it's perhaps she's an advisor or something.
Oh my gosh, you went to see her.
Yes, I went to see her. It was so good. Also one of my recommendations. So I went with Natasha Scholl. She knew Barry Lindemann at Dumbo Feather, who were hosting this event. Exclusive. It wasn't advertised anywhere. I felt so, so mega amazingly
excited.
Oh
my God, I can't believe you got to go.
It was really, really, really good. Dumbo Feather are releasing the podcast as an episode. They must have a podcast platform. I know nothing about anything else on that, but this episode I reckon is really worth a listen. Side note, I met Ash Barty's mindset coach, Ben Crow. That was basically my whole interaction with him. What you just did, I met him briefly. I glanced at him and then
you
I
asked him to be on the podcast. Did you say,
can I just, I was appalling, like just gushed. I just, not even in a coherent way, but perhaps he walked away with the impression that I had heard his, that I was part of his, you know, Ben Crow app. Yeah, I really stuffed it. And then I had, whilst watching Esther talk, I had this other dual monologue of maybe I should go, but I didn't. But I still rate that as one of the highlights of the event. Esther Perel was incredible. I knew that she would be, but she surpassed all expectations. Really interesting questions. I think the thing was that hadn't occurred to me, I don't know why, but obviously she's the host in what she normally does. So you hear her ask questions, but this was like her summarizing her experiences of asking many people questions. So great at themes. There was one point that's really sat with me since towards the end, they opened it up for questions. Even that was interesting the way she did that. So normally you would have a person would put up their hand and ask a question, but she said, no, keep going. So she got five people to ask questions. And she sort of half wrote them down and then she gave responses to each question. I don't know why she did that, but it was interesting in itself. One younger guy, so maybe in his 20s, asked a question about masculinity and what advice she would have for males kind of to address, I don't even think he used the word toxic, but to improve masculinity, say, or patriarchal type things. I thought it was a brave question because many responses to discussions on masculinity kind of do that critique that not all men thing and really give no space for an avenue forward, perhaps in some ways. But she gave such a considered and insightful response about male powerlessness. And I won't do it justice in recapping it. It's definitely worth a listen. That question in particular is toward the end of the podcast and a small part of it. But it was acknowledging the powerlessness that men also feel in what I felt was quite a nuanced way and a way that offered a path forward. She's such an interesting woman. She's the sort of person that Barry made a comment that she seems so alive and she is this person that you just want to be like. She takes time for people. She's fascinating in and of herself, but she would also just be actually really, really fun to hang out with. So that was very, very exciting. Such a massive thank you to Natasha Scholl. It was really good. Okay, so back to This Is Dating podcast. First season, I feel like it's still finding its feet a bit. It's an exploration of dating. Really what the most interesting part of it is they have four people that are single and looking for love and they coach them. So they start to identify what each dater's pattern is. There's a guy, for example, who doesn't realize, but is a real love bomber, goes in hard at the start and then ghosts and fades out. So you have all these people with these kind of different approaches. You listen to them go on two dates.
Oh my God.
And then they kind of had a post-mortem and you catch up with them. So that's like the best bit. And then they have a few episodes that are discussions of dating more broadly, which are not interesting. You just really want to follow the people. And then Esther Perel comes on with one of the daters and has a counselling session because this particular data just seems to repeat the same patterns. Really good. Hits all the notes of voyeurism and awkwardness. And because you only know your own dates, right?
Obviously. That is good. I feel like that is your absolute sweet spot.
It's such a sweet spot. It's also just listening to people flirt well and badly, and I'm desperate to see what each of these people look like, because so much in dating is like,
yeah,
it's visual and all that sort of stuff. So that's a high recommend. Go for the ones, the episodes that are mostly about the dates themselves, my personal opinion. Okay, my next one is a podcast called If Books Could Kill. Have you heard of this podcast?
No.
Okay, so it's Michael Hobbs, who used to be on the You're Wrong About podcast, also a great podcast and still going strong. I think he just wanted to do something different. His co-host is Michael Shamshiri, and what they do is they look at airport bestsellers is what they call these books, but they books like Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers, what other books, books like that, that are hugely popular, the types of things that you would pick up in a bookshop. They're nonfiction books. And then they sort of unpack these books. As someone who has really liked Malcolm Gladwell's work, I did find myself kind of shrinking down in the car with embarrassment, because they really go through and say, you know, this book has become really popular and the ideas within it have become really popular. But really, I think one of the things they say about Gladwell is that his work would never make the fact checking requirements of, say, the New Yorker or the New York Times or all these sorts of things. A lot of it is quite problematic. But the most recent episode is based on a book called The Game. And this was this book that came out in the 2000s, and it was about dating and the world of pickup artists. And so you probably have heard of this book or have heard of people talk about this book. I'd never read this book. The podcast has that wonderful format that I love, where you have one person who has read the book and done all the thinking, and then the other person knows nothing. And and so that other person Explainer. Is kind of playing the role of the listener to the pod. This book just sounds like the most terrible, awful book of all time. But I think what was most interesting about it was they had all these pickup techniques. So like negging might be an example where you criticize people and make them want to be with you and stuff. But they had these small examples of opening lines to get people to talk to you. And I could remember people having said them to me. So one example was a group of guys that might pretend that one in their group had been invited to be on a TV show, and should he do it? So, my friend's been asked to be on, I don't know, The Project. Should he go on it? Yeah. Or The Bachelor, should he go on it? I can remember someone saying that to me. And another technique was you go out with some lint from a dryer in your pocket, and then you put it on
girl's
top and pretend to then discover it and pick it off and say, oh, my God, how long has that been there? And it's like a conversational opener. But it's also a conversational opener that's quite embarrassing for the other person and sort of diminishes. Anyway, really, really fascinating. I think Michael Hobbs is such an interesting guy and talks about things with such nuance. Okay, so that's those two. My next podcast, and this is my last one, is the Mel Robbins podcast. So Mel Robbins, I believe, is no relation to Tony Robbins, but it is in this motivational realm. I think it's only got, maybe it's been out for 3 months. I think she does about 2 episodes a week. It's number one already in that motivational space. So that's pretty impressive. Hit and miss with the topic. Some I'm not interested in at all, but one that is particularly good is this one on manifesting.
I do know that you love a manifest.
Probably the best manifesting podcast I think that I've listened to, because one of the things that she focuses on is she says the big mistake that people make is they make a vision board, but the vision board is all end game stuff. So it's, this is my Ferrari and this is my beach house and this is my me holding an Oscar aloft. But she said you can do some of that, but you also need to visualize the steps along the way. And that is the mistake that people make, is that you have this thing that is so, so distant in the future that there's just no conception or no kind of way of getting from now until then. So she's big on visualizing the steps along the way. And then she has this practice, whilst I love manifesting, I'm actually not that good at doing the things. But this feels like achievable and I will do it. She has, so every day you should, she has this little worksheet thing, which you can get on her website when you sign up to her newsletter and you get it for free. But basically every day you write down five things that you want. They can be massive things. They can be short-term things. They can be whatever they are. And then for each thing, you write down one action you can take today to progress to that goal.
Quite I'm writing clever. Notes. Can you see? Yeah. I'm actually writing notes right now. I love that. I'm adding that to my list immediately.
Yeah. Yep. I like it. She some of her topics, as I said, I'm less interested in, but she's got some cracking ones on. She also has one on, which I haven't followed any of these tips, but one on how to have the it factor, so how to have charisma. And a lot of it is on how to have charisma in an online setting as well. But the two factors, she has this expert come on, and the two factors of charisma, which you actually mentioned a bit earlier, warmth and competence. And she sort of talks about people who are, if you're high competence, low warmth, an example would be Steve Jobs, or you could be high warmth, low competence. Can't think of an example for that, but that you want to. Anyway, so some of the tips that they have, which I'm a little bit skeptical of, but I will repeat anyway. In a Zoom meeting, within the first 10 seconds, you should show your hands. So you should say hi and show your hands, which has to do with like primitive brain sort of stuff to show you don't have weapons.
This is this is what I do all the time, but I don't do it for that purpose.
Well,
I can't control my hands.
It's innate though. This is your warmth coming
through. Is hilarious.
I can't remember what the other was, if you are nervous, don't talk at the top of the breath. So the mistake people make is they breathe in and then they talk from that top point of breath, where you should breathe in if you're going to breathe in deeply and let some air out and then talk the breath down. Like
they are very practical. Yes. You are giving us some deep practical tips today, Colette. I'm really, really happy with these.
Yeah. So that's my podcast recommendations. We will have links in show notes. I have a hard recommend on all of them. They're really, really good.
Well, I don't have as many as you, as always. In fact, I'm realizing as I'm listening to you how much my podcast listening has dropped off this year. But two of the things that I did want to mention that I've really enjoyed is that Between the Covers separate kind of little series called Crafting with Ursula, which I know I've talked about before, but what it
did listened to that from your recommendation previously, not recently.
And what I love about it is that it has introduced me to new writers, particularly Lydia Yukinovich, who I did not know before this year, and now I am a massive fan, and also Adrienne Marie Brown. And it's a really long form interview. I mean, he does so much work in terms of preparing for the interviews, but I just have got a lot, you know, I'd say in terms of things that I've got a lot out of, that's one that I got a lot out of. And the other one is Stephen Johnson, whose newsletter I really recommend, Adjacent Possible. But so he's a US writer, really interested in his books, kind of a science and philosophy thinker, but he's taken over the TEDx podcast. And there's some really great interviews. Again, like they're not all for me in terms of the content, but just in going through them, they're quite short interviews. He's really great at what he does, and just some really super interesting stuff that kind of blows your mind. So they are my two very short recommendations. Mm-hmm. I'm going to immediately go on though, because only last night did I finish watching, because I binged a couple of episodes, the new Netflix series 1899. Have you watched it yet?
Oh, what is it? No, I haven't even heard of it. I thought you were going to say Wednesday.
Oh, my gosh. No, I have not. So it is from the creators of Dark, which I haven't actually seen, though a lot of people have recommended to me. So it is German-based. It is, I think they're calling it supernatural spec fic. It's set on a ship crossing the Atlantic in 1899 with a bunch of immigrants. So everyone's speaking in different languages. So it's subtitled. And the characters are all speaking to each other in different languages. And I just, because you know how I love a deep dive after I finish something, I was having a look at some articles today, and apparently many of the actors, like they didn't kind of, I don't know, subtitle it in English out loud as they were going along. So the actors literally did not know what each other was saying, which is really interesting to think about in terms of process.
Oh, how method. Yeah.
Yeah. Very method. But it is one of those kind of puzzle box mysteries, literally only comes together in the last 10 minutes of the last episode. And just interesting. It's obviously very popular. Like, it's everyone's watching it. There are, I've seen some big critiques of it, as well as people just saying it's ace. Only yesterday did I see a Twitter thread that there is also a, I think, a Brazilian comic, a woman comic artist, who is claiming that the entire series is very similar to a short story that she wrote. So that's, I haven't gone into that yet, but that's a deep dive that I'm going to do.
What a gem. How fascinating.
But just what I've really enjoyed, I think, this year is, the other ones I had down is Beforeigners, which I've talked about before. The SBS yes. One.
So much tension. I think I'm not good with tension.
I love that, because I feel like you are. You do all those incredible other shows.
No, I do like extremely lowbrow housewives. Keep going. Keep talking.
But so really high concept, slightly wacky, deeply bingeable. So those kinds of shows, and this is I was telling my publisher, this is my aim for my book. Something that is like, it's pretty whack, right? Like, there's some concepts in there that are a bit wild, but I'm going to make it so bingeable that you can't put it down. That's the sweet spot that I'm looking for. And that's what I reckon is the kind of the shows that I've really enjoyed this year are those kind of ones. So that's what I'm watching. What are you watching as the year comes to a close?
Oh, I have hardly watched any TV. I don't know what I have been doing. I think because you're
working 4 days a week. And
working 4 days a week. Working the jump from 3 days a week to 4 days a week is a dramatic, dramatic jump. So I haven't watched hardly anything. I caught up on Real Housewives of Potomac, which is excellent. One of my faves. But things have unraveled a bit. But I think a sign of where I am currently at in terms of lots of stuff and not much mental headspace is that I've mentioned the Two T's in a Pod podcast. It's Teddy Mellencamp and Tamara Judge, who are former housewives from the Real Housewives franchise, and they recap episodes. I now find them so, I'm going to say, half compelling, half comforting, that I go to bed and I listen to them. So I make sure I get into bed before Carney does, and I put a 15-minute timer and I go to sleep to their voices. And it's a terrible habit that I have to break, because I keep hearing in all of these podcasts about you should have like a writing problem or a life thing in your head, and your brain will tick over. But my brain is stewing on ridiculous fights between women throwing drinks on each other. And
look, if it helps you sleep at this wacko time of year, then I'm all for it. Tell me, what are your plans for 2023? Let's not go into detail in all of them, but what are your general kind of writing plans for 2023, Catherine Collette? What you can reveal to us anyway?
Well, my middle grade manuscript I am excited for things to be happening with the middle grade manuscript. I don't know what that looks like yet, but I feel excited about it. So excellent. I feel like that will progress in its journey. I've just started a new middle grade something, which makes me really happy, because I think I'm happiest when I have a project that I'm tinkering on and working away at. What else? Comics. I want to keep going with cartoons and comics. I'll hit my 100 days. I've started, as a practice, submitting. You can submit to the New Yorker once a month. So I can pick my best five from the month. The only downside with that is that obviously I pick the best ones or my favorite ones that I've been working on and send them off. But then I have to make them disappear from my Instagram feed. So in my own mental headspace, the worst cartoons are then on my Instagram feed. That's like a minor nuance point in my head. The other thing I'm going to do is actually commit to putting the books I have read on Instagram. It's a very easy task. It takes a bit of effort to craft a description, but really not that much effort. And newsletters is the other thing I want to talk about, but let's do your goals and what you're going to be focusing on first.
So first up, I am focusing on finishing this edit of the novel. And while there's nothing official to say that hopefully at some time in the not too distant future, one might be out talking about one's book in the world as well. So that's a super exciting thing, but the front of mind right now, let's get the thing finished first. So that's kind of all of my brain. I will be continuing with the PhD and having to get some big amounts of words and thinking in. Very possibly I will have to take some leave from that next year, but we'll see how that goes. So that's kind of a big other thinking thing in my brain as well. I want to put it out there in manifesting land to say that by when we are sitting to do the finale next year at the end of 2023, I want to have interviewed for the masterclass either RF Kuang or Ling Ma, who I just mentioned in this episode, Jennifer Egan or Liz Gilbert. So if I can have said that I've interviewed one of those for the master series next year, I will feel deeply satisfied on my hustle. And also, yes, recommitting to the Instagram because it was desperately hard for me to find what I'd read this year. And so I, yeah, want to keep doing that. And the not for me. So really important. One of the things, I've already done a few no's for engagements for next year. And so I'm really trying to keep this kind of inner criteria when it works and when I'm financially able to do so in those circumstances to be able to say not for me on certain gigs and to understand that by saying no to those gigs, I'm saying yes to the writing time, etc. And I tell you what, I want a new idea. I like, well, I mean, I've got a few ideas floating around, but by this time next year, I want to be writing a new novel or whatever I'm doing next, which is kind of exciting.
I want my middle grade to have a home. That's my manifest.
Yes, let's manifest it. We're going hard. Yep. Let's talk about what's coming for the podcast.
This season, we are returning to our first-time roots.
We hear all the time from listeners who've gone from thinking about writing a book to starting to write a book to having their own debut author experience.
And one of the things that these new authors say is that they've gone back to the very beginning and listened to the episodes that cover off all of the various milestones.
So this year, we're going back too. We want to capture that first time again ourselves.
We're going to be following a first-time author across the year, catching up multiple times along the way.
And our very first follower first-timer is Megan Rogers, author of The Heart is a Star.
Megan Rogers began her working life as an editorial assistant at Allen & Unwin before moving to the State Library of Victoria in marketing. In 2014, Megan finished a PhD in creative writing at RMIT, which resulted in the book Finding the Plot, A Maternal Approach to Madness in Literature, published by the feminist publisher Demeter Press. She also has a Bachelor of Arts Science, Monash, a Diploma of Professional Writing and Editing at the infamous RMIT, a Graduate Diploma in Professional Communication from Deakin, and a Master of Marketing from Monash. Megan lives in the Mornington Peninsula outside of Melbourne. Welcome, Megan, to the First Time Podcast.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
Now, as you may or may not know, in this podcast, we always start at the very beginning. You are our first follower, first-time author, and it will be no different. So tell us, have you always been a writer?
Yes. I think that I sound very cliche when I answer this question because I am, you know, I was one of those little girls who wanted this from about the age of four.
But the other thing that we have coming up for you, because we know that you like to listen to podcasts, even though you're at the beach, is that we have our summer series, which we have collated our top 10 episodes ever. We've smooshed around the data a little bit. The finale of season one isn't in there, for instance, but they are 10 episodes that we know you love and we love, and we have popped them together for you in a fabulous series that will start coming out the week before Christmas and take you all the way through January. For writers who are looking to purchase themselves a Christmas present, I've got a couple of workshops that are coming up early in the year. Check out season one of Writers Vic and their amazing program for season one. Lots of incredible workshops in there. And I will be doing a boot camp for beginning writers, which occurs online over 3 Sundays in February and March. And we'll be doing creative habits, heaps of generative writing, and some pitching and publishing stuff. I'm really looking forward to that. And the Talking the Talk workshop that I did for Writing New South Wales, I am taking online. There's two sessions, a daytime and an evening session in February. There's a link in the show notes to that. Only limited spot. It's half sold, so get in quick if you want to come to that. And that's it. That's the end of season.
That's it. It's bloody been an epic season, hasn't it? We several times looked at each other and said, this is like we've done too much.
We've done too much.
But now I'm going to miss it. So
I'm going to miss it too. And
goes to show.
Let's just say that we could not have done so much. And in fact, when we looked at each other in those moments, we would have dissolved into floods of tears and said the podcast off if it were not for the incredible Jill Langhammer, who has seen us through this year to new heights, looked after us and all kinds of things. She is the person who gets in touch with you if you email us, helps us out on the socials and just about does everything for us in the background. So we are so glad to have Jill on board. Of course, as always, we are glad to have Phoebe, who still hasn't left us after 5 years, and we are so very grateful for that, making us sound good since 2018, 2017?
Yeah, 2018.
Gosh, we've been doing this a while.
Phoebe looks amazing. Like seeing her in person, Phoebe. Yeah. And of course, the other people, persons that we want to say thank you to are, of course, our listeners. Thanks for listening. Thanks for emailing and messaging and talking to us at events. If not for all of you, it would just be us looking at each other and telling each other the same things in a less, organized fashion. So a great deal of gratitude to you guys too.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.